Let's kick it off. Hi everybody, my name is Madeline DeVoe. I'm the Content Marketing Manager here at iWave, and I'm really excited to welcome you to today's webinar. This is Are You Prospecting with Blinders? So we are very excited to dive into this topic today. It's Black Philanthropy Month, the month of August, and I can't wait to introduce you to our presenter today, Regina Allison. But before I hand it over, I'll just go over our housekeeping items. So you may have noticed everybody is in listen-only mode or muted, but we want to make sure that we get all of your questions. So if you have any questions at any time throughout the presentation, just pop those into the question box. We're going to be doing about 10 to 15 minutes at the end, and we'll try to get through as many questions as we can in that time. And we're also going to be sending the recording of this webinar in a follow-up email along with Regina's slides. So make sure to keep an eye out for that later on this afternoon. So I am very excited to introduce to you our presenter today. So Regina Allison is owner of Research Pro, Central Ohio's leading prospect development partner. With total dollars identified in the billions, she has specialized in major gift campaigns for a spectrum of organizations, including the Ohio State University, Ohio History Connection, I Am Boundless, Columbus Academy, and Heal Her Foundation. Her 20 years of prospect research and management include software development, end user training, leadership coaching, knowledge management, moves management, systems management, and development operations. Regina serves on the Women's Impact Initiative for Global Association of Fundraising Professionals. On her local AFP board, she chairs the Central Ohio Chapters Committee for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. Previous industry leadership includes board president of Ohio Prospect Research Network and chapter leader for APRA International. A self-proclaimed data geek, Regina is also an artist, writer, philanthropist, and TEDx speaker. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Regina to start today's webinar.
Awesome, thank you, Madeline. Let me get my webcam turned on here so hopefully everyone can see me now as well. I want to thank you for the opportunity. Thanks to iWave for the opportunity, for the partnership to discuss this really important topic. And thank everyone that has joined today. This is amazing. So we're here to talk about, are you prospecting with blinders? And hint, yes, yes, you are. So Madeline did an amazing job just sort of providing that bio. Thank you for that. And this slide is just a timeline view of that. Just again, to highlight some information. I've been in prospect development and major gift fundraising for the last 20 years. And 3 years ago, I started my own firm, Research Pro, to focus on data, donors and dollars, and to really equip nonprofit leaders with the tools that they need to reach goal. So that's sort of my formal bio, but the informal version, the more personal version of Regina and who I am, yes, I do own Research Pro. Yes, I am a prospect development partner, but my friends and colleagues also call me Money. So I've earned that moniker, and like many of you in prospect research, I like to be in the background. So they take great joy in teasing me and calling me out in the room when I come in, and here comes Money. So they definitely call me Money, and that's also because my total dollars identified has far exceeded $1 billion. They also call me Ya. So Ya is my day name. I was born on a Thursday, and a few years ago, I had an opportunity to visit Ghana in West Africa, and there learned of the tradition, the Akan tradition of being given a day name based on the day that you were born. And so being born on a Thursday, my day name is Ya. And what that means is the idea is that based on the day that you were born, similar to the zodiac sign, you possess certain characteristics and principles and desires. And the way that that translates for me as a Ya is that I'm committed to social justice. I'm committed to fighting for the underdog. I'm committed to rallying the troops toward a common goal. And so I take great pride in both of those names. And also, personally, I love hip hop. I don't want to date myself, but 80s hip hop, 90s dance hall, I love, love, love it. And if you're with me, throw your hands in the air and let me know. But one of my favorite lyrics here, I want to rule my destiny, which is a lyric from one of my favorite dancehall artists, Buju Banton. And if anyone is a Jimmy Fallon fan, you saw Buju perform a few nights ago, or maybe last week. So I want to rule my destiny, like so many other people. You know, I want to be a change agent. I want to make my mark in this world. I want to make the world a better place. Also, a favorite lyric of mine here with Chubby Competitor, I'm quoting Biggie Smalls. So really embracing the idea that when I enter the room of philanthropy, I'm not elite, I'm not petite, I'm not white, and that's okay. And so I am the Chubby Competitor, and I bring a different lens to the game of philanthropy, and I embrace that. I'm also a maker, an artist. I love to create. I'm a creative. So, you know, I'm always building or crafting. I love multimedia art and textiles. And like Erykah Badu, you know, I'm an artist and I'm sensitive about my work. I'm also married to a Ghanaian. And so that's where my last name comes from. So up until about 6 years ago, I was Regina Johnson. And I know some of my long-term colleagues are on this, are in the room today and are familiar with that. But I am now Regina Alison, married to a Ghanaian. So I have to declare Ghanaian Jollof is the only true Jollof. End of story. So find me on Instagram at The Research Pro, and we can debate that. But that's a little bit more about me on the personal level. What gets me here today? So last year in October, I had the opportunity, I was invited to speak on the TEDx stage. And that really is, again, because my colleagues know that I'm the money person when we talk about fundraising, when we talk about prospecting, bring Regina. So I was very grateful for this opportunity, but I knew I was going to be talking about ideas about fundraising in an audience full of people who were not fundraisers. They were not professional fundraisers. They didn't identify as philanthropists. They were not data geeks like me and many of us here. And so I had to find a way to craft my story that was compelling and engaging and relevant. And so what I decided to do after several coaching sessions of no content, I got to the point where I'm just going to stick with the facts. So from the TEDx stage, from that experience, I learned a few things. One, I learned that, you know, a simple carpet can be quite intimidating. I also learned that having a professional makeup artist is an experience that I deserve in my life and should have again and again. And I encourage all of you to do it as well. But I learned, you know, the ability to, again, tell that story in a relevant way and focus on the facts. And that's what we're going to focus on today. So fact number one, the first fact that we're familiar with in our industry, philanthropy is big business. It's big. It's not just, you know, this rusty lockbox on the side of the road. Although many people and many organizations approach it as such, we know it's big business. How big? $449 billion big. And so last year, these numbers come from the Giving USA report that just came out about 6 weeks ago. So last year, the total was like 427, I think. I may be off a little bit. But at that point, it represented about 2% of the national GDP. And that's still about the same. And so I was curious, like, what else is 2%? You know, what compares to that? Agriculture compares to that. So this is a massive industry. It's a big business. And when we talk about that $449 billion, we also have to take a look at the facts of where that money is coming from. Oftentimes, we like to think about foundations, and we like to talk about corporate grants, and we overlook our individual prospects. So of that total giving, 69% came from individuals, and 10% came from bequests. So while those are separate categories, the Giving Institute does refer to those comprehensively when it talks about individual giving. So we can look at that as 79% of that $449 billion is coming from individuals. And oftentimes, that is not major gifts. So there's a fact about prospects that we need to take a very clear look at. Also a fact that I uncovered in doing the research for the TEDx talk, African Americans are the most charitable group of people in the country. And I know that that really pushes against a lot of the narratives we have about giving, about donors, about African Americans. But the general consensus, the research is, all comes to the same conclusion. African Americans are the most charitable group of people in the country. And more than that, they always have been since, quote, the beginning of time. Now, for me, as a prospect researcher, you know, you say something like that, you put that type of parameter on it, then I need to go back to, well, what is the beginning of time? I'm really curious about that. But for the sake of this conversation, you know, and that presentation, really just focusing on the fact that African Americans are the most charitable group of people. And so these facts and others that I'm going to share come from a number of different sources, and I have them listed here. So it's just prettier to share it in this nice, concise list, rather than trying to intermingle it in the other designs. But these are the sources, you know, that I'm using and that I'm citing. And there, I'm sure there are other researchers here. Feel free to dig around into some of these resources, and you can find this information too. And I welcome continued conversation about ongoing findings. So when we talk about African Americans being the most charitable group of people, what does that number look like? And so a year ago, last October, the most recent number that I could find was, on average, African Americans donate about $11 billion collectively each year. That's a massive, massive number. Clearly, Black gives back. But $11 billion is also so massive, it's hard to really wrap yourself around that. What does that mean? Who is that? Was that a single person? Was that two people? Was that, you know, 20 multi-million dollar gifts? What exactly does that $11 billion look like? And what do those donors look like? What are they doing? How are they behaving? Again, I'm a prospect researcher. I can't help myself. So those facts, I had to dig into that. And these are some facts about, very specifically, about the prospect behavior of African-American donors. So 2/3 of African-American households donate, give, make non-charitable deductions, charitable gifts to nonprofit organizations. Approximately 2/3 of all African-American households. That's a lot. 30% of African-American donors give because of family tradition. That's legacy, 30%. In comparison, only 18% of white donors report giving because of family tradition. 30% of African American donors give because of family tradition. African American donors are twice as likely to believe that their gift makes a difference. They are twice as likely than any other group of donors to believe in the impact. They bring the belief in the impact to the table. You just have to deliver it. Percent of African American donors report plans to increase their giving in the next 3 to 5 years. In comparison, only 24% of white donors report plans for increased gifts. I don't know about you, but I want the prospect that comes in the door ready to repeat. The White House Council on Economic Advisors, the White House Council of Economic Advisors, reported that African Americans are significantly more likely to give than whites. These are a host of facts that really speak to the prospecting behavior that we as prospect identification professionals can start to look at. African American donors are 4 times as likely to use social media to raise funds. And so if you follow the Giving USA reports, if you've been tuned into their most recent findings, African American donors, millennial donors, social media giving is totally disrupting philanthropy. And that's a huge prospect base that is currently outside of our traditional prospecting. So we have to recognize that Black gives back. So because of these facts, I not only make the case that African Americans are the most charitable, I make the case that African Americans are the country's top prospects. When we're talking about individual giving, we're talking about legacy gifts, repeat gifts, and belief and impact. African Americans are indeed the top prospects. But when we talk about philanthropy, typically this is what comes to mind, the Monopoly Man. When I ask people to define what does a philanthropist look like, tell me what is a philanthropist, who's a philanthropist, it always comes back to this type of an image. And just for kicks, last night, because I thought, well, someone will say, no, I don't think of the Monopoly Man. That's not the only narrative. Just for kicks, last night I did a Google search on philanthropy. And these are the images that popped up, the first images that popped up. So there is a clear skew, a certain lens that we're using to look at philanthropy. And as prospect researchers, as fundraisers, I'm sure we recognize these people, but it's almost laughable. It's almost too good to be true. The example is almost too good to be true. That this is the image, that these are the images, this is the narrative that even Google finds. So certainly this is a challenge within our industry, and that's why we're here today. So this is the narrative, and this is one narrative. However, the data proves African Americans are the country's top prospects. And so just kind of comparing the visuals. So here are what do those African American donors look like? Here is just a slight sample, a teeny tiny sample. It's the couple, it's the entrepreneur that has her new product line on the shelves in Target. It's veterans, it's service people, it's essential workers, It's our managers, it's our, you know, our leaders, etc. It's the tech startup, the entrepreneur. Black women entrepreneurs right now are leading small business growth. So it's the individual, the solo entrepreneur, tech startup. It's the prospect development professional that has gone out on her own and has a passion for nonprofits and saving the world. So clearly, there's a disconnect. And so we should be, I think most of us are used to this model, this donor cycle, the cycle of identification, qualification, cultivation, solicitation, stewardship. That's nothing new, but there's a disconnect. And having worked on both sides, on all sides of fundraising, as a philanthropist, as a fundraiser on the front lines, as a prospect development professional, all those different perspectives, it allows me to recognize the disconnect that exists in the prospect development cycle. There is a disconnect in the identification and the discovery and qualification. And so I know that many of us recognize that we are challenged by this and we are not quite sure how to move past it. And hopefully we can identify some solutions today. But that disconnect is there. And I think that we as prospect development professionals, as the researchers, as the database administrators, whatever our title is within that operation, we have a very unique position and I think responsibility to sort of carry the torch of diversifying our donor base. And this is where I think that disconnect often happens. So about those blinders, because we all have them, we just do. This is how we do it, right? So we, you know, we need to build out a pipeline list. Where do I start? I don't have any data. I don't have any, you know, great data. I don't have very much data. I'm going to do a zip code search. I'm going to run some criteria. I'm going to run a report, do some screenings based on zip codes. And that's a great place to start. I start there. But what do we overlook? If 2/3 of African-American households are giving and we're running zip code searches, how heavily populated are the zip codes that we're searching? You know, are African-Americans in those zip codes? So I think about my own hometown. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and the suburbs that exist here. Some of them are diverse, some of them are not. Some are more exclusive, traditionally exclusive than not. And so those happen to be the zip codes that we like to search because we assume that's where the wealth is. That is where the wealth is, but it's not the only place that the wealth is. So zip code searches out the gate are problematic. They can be problematic. We also look at our families, right? And so we all know that my area certainly has those same few families. They support everything. Their name is on everything. And we love those families, right? We love those families. We love their companies. We love their community impact, their public-private partnership, etc. We love that. We certainly need it, but oftentimes that's where we begin our prospecting, our families and their friends. So who does that include? That allows us, that positions us to begin prospecting with blinders because we know what that looks like. Our social media. So I encourage you just to take a look at your social media, just the visual narrative. Is it inclusive? Is it representative? You know, is it monolithic? Is it, you know, just homogenous in whatever way? So think about that. You know, does it represent the people that you want to engage? Do they see themselves there? whether or not they're African American or some or other ethnicity, some other category of diversity, ability, orientation, gender, etc. Do they see themselves reflected in your visual story? And speaking of story, oftentimes we don't tell our impact story. And so when we're talking about African American donors specifically, who are twice as likely to believe in your impact, you absolutely need to tell the story. We know it's not even just African American donors. 80% of donors give because of impact, typically. At the same time, only 20% of nonprofits tell their story. You know, few actually acknowledge the gift. Even fewer follow up with the impact story. So there's a space where we are missing and prospecting with blinders. We're missing out on a prospect pool because we're not telling the impact story. And then finally, assumptions of poverty. And we're all guilty of this. I have seen this time and time again in all sorts of organizations, size, scope. As a staff member, as a board member, we make assumptions of poverty. We assume that people that live outside of those certain wealthy zip codes can't give, won't give. We assume that they are poor. We make assumptions of poverty about the people that our organizations serve. We refuse to engage, oftentimes organizations refuse to ask and engage people that come to their door to receive services. We just won't do it. We make the assumption of poverty, and this is incredibly troubling. We most definitely are leaving money on the table. People, everyone wants to support. Everyone wants to give. Everyone, there's space for everyone to be a philanthropist. And I believe that we as fundraisers and as nonprofit professionals have a responsibility to make philanthropy accessible to everyone in our community. So this is how we do it. And it's definitely indeed with blinders. This is how we should do it. So right now, APRA PD is going on virtual, and I know that some of us are making a choice today to be here or there, and so I appreciate those that have chosen to be here, and shout out to those that will watch this later after participating in APRA. So I went to the APRA Beyond Prospecting, the APRA podcast, which is right now featuring Frank Cessna, who is the keynote for APRA this year, and he's a journalist and fundraiser. So listening to his podcast a few times in the last week and just kind of taking in the advice and letting it sort of marinate, Frank advises us to talk about what we're doing and why we're doing it and why we're doing it together. When we're talking about building a culture of philanthropy and making those connections and relationships, to not talk about, let's be philanthropic, let's build culture, but to be more specific about what you're doing, why it's important to do it together. He goes on to say, what is our shared mission and what are we trying to do? So this speaks directly to the African American prospect, the belief in the impact, the legacy giving. This is what we should be doing. And this is basic fundraising, right? These are basic fundraising 101. Build the relationships, the authentic and genuine relationships. Find what is inspirational. Find the inspiration and tap into it. Find that shared motivation, the shared mission, that shared big idea. Frank also mentions that. If you haven't listened to the podcast, I encourage you to check it out. It's amazing and quite insightful. But again, this is fundraising 101. And the impact, that shared impact is so important. I also want to be very clear about what we're not to do. So this presentation, I've presented this information and these facts in a variety of audiences thus far for different purposes. But the objective remains the same, you know, and that this is about inclusion, not exploitation. This is about creating discourse about how to truly be inclusive and foster representation, foster authentic engagement. This is not, you know, the 1, 2, 3, this is how you get Black people to give you money. It's about inclusion and not exploitation. So this is how we can do it. Acknowledge the blinders. We have them. Most of us, we're all here today. We're taking that first step and probably have in other ways to acknowledge the blinders. We have them. They exist. We can move past them. Enforce representation. So enforce feels really strong, right? But it's necessary. Oftentimes in nonprofit space, what I hear, what I experience is, oh, we would love to diversify our applicant pool. We just can't find applicants. We would love to have a more diverse board. We just can't find applicants. We would love to diversify. We just can't find the diverse people. And I think that is a little bit of an easy out. And so we have to reposition ourselves that whether or not we can find them with a quick look, we're going to enforce this representation. If it takes digging a couple layers deeper, if it takes, you know, tapping into resources that we're just not naturally attached to, we're going to do that. We're going to enforce this representation and make it a priority. And not just for African Americans, obviously, but truly, representation, the people that we live with and that we serve. So we also can embrace social justice. And I think many of our organizations right now are facing this and are confronting this. So for example, I'll just name off some organizations here in my hometown. So City Year Columbus provides, you know, job training, internships, etc., support services to support Black and Brown teenagers and young adults. And it's all about career development, career opportunity, etc. So it's hard for City Year to talk about advancing career opportunities for Black and Brown young people and not confront the police brutality that Black and Brown young people are protesting about. So it's hard to distance yourself from the priorities of the people that you serve. It's hard to be a food bank and continue to give food away and not take a position on perhaps housing or wage equity. That can be a challenge. So we have to embrace social justice. We can't pretend like some of these societal ills don't exist or they're outside our door, especially when the people that we serve, the people coming through our doors, the communities that we say we care about are confronting them every day. So embracing social justice and taking a stance one way or the other. Something else we can do is practice evergreen allyship. And so if you define yourself and identify yourself as an ally, that should be evergreen allyship. That's not bandwagon allyship. Oh, there's a new hashtag. Oh, there's a new tragedy. There's a new tragedy right now. You know, it's not just the latest trend. This is evergreen. This is ongoing. This goes beyond social media. What are you doing to acknowledge the blinders, to enforce that representation, to dig a little bit deeper, to make sure that you bring in new people? So evergreen allyship in different ways. So something else that we can do is celebrate intersectionality. And this is really important. So oftentimes intersectionality has a negative connotation. You know, no one wants to be the victim of intersectionality, right? But I think we have an opportunity to celebrate intersectionality, to explore it and celebrate it. And what I mean here specifically, so in my web blog in preparation for this, I use the line, when and where I enter, intersectionality follows. What does that mean? I'm an African American. I'm a woman. I'm of a certain age. I'm a mom. You know, I'm a mom of a young child, and I'm also a mom of an adult child. So those are very different perspectives. I'm a philanthropist. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a solopreneur. So that intersectionality lends a lot of different perspectives. But when we're talking about African American donors specifically, I think it's really interesting if we go deeper. Let's define African American. Who is that? My husband is Ghanaian. Does he count in that total? We have a daughter together. 20 years from now, will she count in the African American total? My daughter, what about second and third generation Americans? You know, my daughter has a friend whose family is from another African country, you know, but she grew up here, you know, so she identifies as American. Does she count in that African American total? And I also have friends and colleagues that are from Jamaica. You know, I have friends and colleagues that are from other countries, from Haiti, from the Dominican Republic, from different, you know, Caribbean islands. So do they count in the African American total? So that type of intersectionality, what does that mean? How do we engage those people and do it in an authentic way? African American is not a single monolith. It is not just one thing. How do we explore that and celebrate that and engage that? So most importantly, we have to have the conversation. They're difficult. They're uncomfortable. We have to have them and continue to have them. So that's what I have to share today. And I hope that, you know, this conversation has sparked some ideas for you about how you, what blinders you're wearing, how you can begin to take those blinders off. And typically I do very interactive question and answer ongoing during the presentation. Today I'm reserving questions for the end, but I certainly want this conversation to continue during our Q&A. So please do begin to share your questions, share your comments. What are some things that are working in your shop? Maybe you tried something and it was a total fail and you want to get some feedback on it. So at this point, I would love to hear from you.
Awesome. I'm going to hop back on here to sort of facilitate questions throughout your presentation. So thank you so much and continue to pop those questions in here. If we don't get to them live today, you know, we can reach out to you and we'll also be writing a follow-up blog with some of these Q&As as well. So I'll get started. Let me see here. So somebody mentioned, and I think this was regards to the stats that you had presented early on in the webinar, does the foundation number include family foundations as well?
That's a really good question. I want to say that that is complicated. I've listened to a couple of different like information sessions from the Giving Institute. In some cases, it does, but not always. And so I would prefer to like go back and like quote them exactly, but I'm pretty sure that they were saying that in some cases, yes, because it's very clear, you know, who the donor was. But then if that family foundation lives like within a community foundation or lives as a donor advised fund somewhere, then it may come in as like under the total of foundations, if that makes sense.
Well, thank you. And this one sort of came in as a comment, but I have a question that kind of goes along with it. So the family tradition stat is really important for donor longevity. we're always looking for new ways to get multi-generational giving underway. So my question along with that is, do you have any advice for sort of fostering that multi-generational giving?
Yeah, so are we talking about like specific, well, I don't think it matters if it's African-American or, you know, someone else. That first bringing them in the door, when we're talking about African-American specifically, creating that authentic relationship and opportunity for relationship, authentic and relevant, and then engaging the entire family. So creating opportunities for the children to get involved in, whether or not that's volunteering or doing penny fundraisers, et cetera. The teenagers giving young people opportunities to build, design, and lead campaigns of their own. They really dominate the social media space right now. So giving the different generations within the family the opportunity, or creating like a family giving project, if you're talking about younger families. If you're maybe thinking about families where the parents are older and the children are adults, and then now that we have grandchildren, great grandchildren, etc., like bringing the entire family to the table to have that gift conversation. And if you're talking about major gifts, then with that primary donor, you're figuring out who's important, who is the influencer, who is helping make this decision, and then bringing those people, inviting all of those family members to the table. But I think those are the practices that we would use across the board.
Awesome. Cool. And we've got lots more questions coming in, so I really appreciate that. Like I said, the ones we don't get to here, we're going to try to cover in a follow-up blog post, or we'll reach out to you. But another few that came in, somebody asks, do you have insights on the type of engagement or activities that attract African-American donors and prospects, especially in the time of COVID-19?
Well, I mean, social media. So the Giving Compass report that African Americans are 4 times as likely to use social media. That is a huge untapped, you know, pool, I believe. So I would start there. And then, so in starting there, then you have to do the work. What does your visual narrative look like as it stands? Is it compelling? Is it interesting? And be honest with yourself about that.
Great. And another question that came in, do you have some suggestions to help our board members dig deeper to find those diverse new board members when prospecting?
Yeah. So I think looking outside of our industry a little bit, tapping into the people that you do have, that you are connected to. So what we have done, like I serve on the board for my local AFP and I chair Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. One thing that we have begun to do is build a database of, we call them our diversity contacts for the ease of naming the spreadsheet. But we've begun to populate this list of people that we on the committee, we know have some engagement in nonprofit work, community service, et cetera. Are some sort of a professional? It could be a legal professional, a marketing professional, et cetera. So building out this list, basically, and then making sure that we get our promotional materials in front of these people. Another thing that I know Cincinnati is doing, or that AFP in Cincinnati is doing, is a New Faces of Fundraising program. So really picking individuals to go through, to be a cohort and sort of go through this nonprofit training experience. And that includes exploring board service, tapping into leadership programs in your city. I know I participated in a number of professional leadership, African-American leadership programs here. Most cities have them. Tapping into that and pulling those cohorts into your mission, introducing yourself to those people. It could be reaching beyond your very obvious and close Professional Association. Locally, we have a Black Data Processors Association. So they are not connected to nonprofit. They know nothing about APRA. They know nothing about AFP, but they're all about data and stats and data analysis. So I think finding those connections in those other associations, it's possible. Maybe you just have to dig, look a little further out than usual.
Awesome. And we did get a couple of questions around this topic, but somebody says, since you mentioned that African Americans are the most philanthropic, what areas resonate the most with the African American community? Where do their dollars go?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. So I'll share one stat. The Chronicle of Philanthropy reports that nine out of every $10 goes to the African American church or some sort of religious institution. And I mean, that's one of those where it's like, that's the stat. But I want to push back on that a little bit because we also know that faith-based giving is on the decline. And I've been involved in other projects that specifically address the fact that you can't tap into African Americans in the church. You can't rely on that anymore. That idea of use the Black church to reach Black people is outdated, especially with everyone that is 45 and under. So then there's that stat, you know, $9 out of $10 goes to the Black church. But then there are all of these other trends that we have to look at as well. So faith-based, certainly education is another one. Social justice is another. And the thought just like kind of escaped. Education, social justice, like social good is what I'm trying to think of.
Another great question that came in, somebody asks, how can we protect against tokenizing and patronizing behaviors? A lot of fundraisers don't have the comfort and sensibility regarding reaching out to people who aren't straight white men.
Yeah, so I think first just acknowledging that and being very upfront about that. And so this is something that, again, we confront routinely through my role with AFP. One, creating space for conversations for white people to have their own sort of conversations and deal with their own things themselves, as well as in conjunction with having open space, brave space, where we can explore some of these uncomfortable topics. Some of that could be like active bystander training. The other piece, again, about being honest about where you are, recognize that if your board is all white, your leadership is all white, your social media is white, and then you ask non-white people to come in, your narrative has already demonstrated that they're not welcome, that they don't see themselves there. They physically don't see themselves there. So deal with that internally first, deal with that authentically first, and do that work. And then, find people that are willing to kind of coach you with that, partner, go along that journey with you. So like someone like me, I'm willing to go along that journey with my white colleagues, not to solve their problems, but just like we're in partnership together. I feel like I'm starting to ramble, but I think there's a lot of internal work that has to happen first that we like to skim over and say, give me the quick fix. How can I get brown people in the door without really addressing what needs to happen internally first?
Mm-hmm. We do have time for a couple more. So somebody was actually asking if you can share the information again for the podcast that was mentioned, or maybe elaborate a little bit?
For the APRA podcast?
Yes.
So the APRA podcast is Beyond Prospecting. And it's Frank Sesno is up right now. And I'll be up, and I think in a couple weeks. It's myself, Sarah Bernstein, and Lori Hood Lawson will be on the APRA podcast in the next few weeks as well. So I would say stay tuned and keep checking in. You go to aprahome.org for more details about their podcast. I hope that's the podcast that you're asking about.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Let's see. We'll just go through one more here. So somebody says, I really struggle with showing the money is there. Minority populations often aren't displaying wealth and philanthropy in visible and public ways. Any proxies for wealth and philanthropy that you can share?
So again, I would encourage us to think about the way that we use zip code searches. And so maybe be intentional about using a different zip code that you wouldn't typically use. And I'm thinking about my own city. It's a major city, and I know that it's a pretty typical American city. So even in our lower, our impoverished zip codes, there are people of wealth. They live there, they give. I think that we miss it because we don't include those zip codes, so those people never bubble up. So if we start to look in different places, I think the prospects will bubble up. It's just the issue is where we're looking. So I would encourage you to think about looking in different zip codes. Think about searching on, you could do some sort of like reverse searching. So think about a Black cause, or like maybe it's a HBCU. So pull a donor list. You could do this in donor search. You could do this in iWave. You could do this in a variety of tools, but certainly you could do this in iWave. So do a donor search or do a pull a donor list based on criteria, like the recipient, do a search on the recipient and then see who's giving there. If there are any like big names or any big gifts, then do the individual research so you're like kind of researching backwards. And that would be one way to approach it. So certainly, yeah, I do that in iWave pretty typically, not so much for like finding Black donors necessarily, but finding donors that support causes like mine. So that would be one approach. I had to think that through a little bit.
Awesome. Well, I do think that's all the time we have for today. We'll have a bit of time for a send off here. I'm going to turn off my webcam because I find it's glitching a little bit, but I'll leave, if you want to leave up there, that's all right. So like I said, we will be sending this webinar recording in a follow-up email. So keep an eye out for that later on this afternoon. And I just want to extend a huge thank you to you, Regina, for sharing your insights and all of this great information. Even though Black Philanthropy Month is coming to an end in August, obviously this is a topic that we're going to be committed to continuing to educate ourselves on, and we want to continue to share resources to, embrace diversity and inclusion and talk about this more. So I will pass it over to you for the final send-off for everybody, but just wanted to say a big thank you to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you to iWave. Thank you, Madeline and Dana. I love our partnership, and I've been in partnership since the beginning, like 3 years now. And so this is, I really appreciate this opportunity to utilize this platform to talk about this. And I think based on the attendance and the registration, we know that this is an important topic and certainly one that is valid throughout the year And, you know, not just for African American donors, we're talking about that in August, but this applies to all groups of donors, you know, all ethnicities, nationalities, et cetera. We can start to look at how those different groups give in ways that we can remove our blinders. Maybe we're talking about millennials, et cetera, really moving past that traditional donor model. I encourage us to do that. And I encourage you to stay connected, talk data to me, talk donor to me, you know, find me on social media and connect. Thank you for coming. And thank you again to iWay. I appreciate the partnership immensely.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for attending, and enjoy the rest of your day.